So we know that the Tasmanian Fire Service have been working on this bushfire modelling software that allows them to better predict and attack fires. How well is it being used? Well, Professor Ted Lefroy is the director of the Centre for Environment at the University of Tasmania. And he has, I guess, an outsider's view on modelling and some of the discussions about modelling. He shared some of those views on The Conversation, where he talked about a second fire that we didn't hear so much about that the modelling really assisted with. And we've asked him to come in and just sort of tease it out a bit for us. Ted, good morning.
Morning, Rick.
And thanks for coming in on this balmy day. It's terrific, isn't it?
It is.
For a summer holiday. So, Tess, what's your relationship and how do you relate to the TAS Fire Services modelling, just so we know where to place you?
Sure. Well, increasingly, as we deal with complex issues in environment and education, public health, juvenile justice, the idea that that researchers go away and do research, produce the answer and then just deliver it in a sort of one-way transfer no longer holds true, because with these complex issues, often the answers unexpected, you need to understand the context. And so this role of knowledge brokers has evolved to help interpret the result. So you're literally, you're a go-between, you're an intermediary between the researchers and the people who use the research. And I had the good fortune recently to sit in on a workshop of some of Australia's best fire modellers that was hosted by our centre. And David Bowman ran this meeting. And I was basically sitting in the corner for 3 days watching and listening and realising that particularly in the bushfire inquiry, that I think the inquiry had misinterpreted the way that modelling, the role that modelling plays. It's only one of many sources of information used. It's not an oracle. You don't press a button and it gives you the answer. And part of that workshop was a minute-by-minute account of the Molesworth fire and the Gretna fire, which happened in February, just over the back of Mount Wellington. And really, it was very close to being a serious issue for Hobart. And the account they gave was one where the modelling was used very appropriately as one of their sources of information and helped them get on top of both fires very quickly. So the context was all important. There's a saying that for every complex problem, there's a simple solution that's wrong. And what was wrong about the inquiry was to say, well, the institution was to blame, their misuse of modelling was to blame. It's never that simple. And so the reason I wrote the article was to defend their use of modelling around fires in general, which seems entirely appropriate.
Modelling is very controversial, really, because clearly the climate models, for example, have been attacked a lot lately, and the climate is such an incredibly complex system. The idea that you could reliably or accurately model that you could get enough inputs to reliably model it without actually just recreating the whole climate is questionable. So what did you hear about bushfire modelling that made you think, oh yeah, that's a pretty robust structure?
Okay, well look, the reason we use mathematical models is we can't hold all the different variables and uncertainty in our head. And with a fire, it's to do with the amount of fuel, how dry it is, the weather at the time, the wind direction and speed. As Mike Brown said after the inquiry came out, If the wind direction changes by 5 degrees, 12 hours later after a fire run, you're in a very different location. So to use a prediction that's 12 or even 24 hours out and issue warnings on that basis, you know, the result is going to be warning fatigue. Lots of people are going to be anxious, unnecessarily anxious. So, you know, they waited until the next day, until they had a revised forecast, and then issued their warnings. And that seems to be very appropriate given the uncertainty with things like wind direction and speed. But in the case of the fire at Gretna and the recent one we saw at Tolman's Hill, they put the location, the current weather conditions straight into the model. They can see the potential for it moving in the next few hours and they jump on it straight away. And that's an appropriate use. But the further out you go, the greater those uncertainties and the more they have to rely on local knowledge, terrain, the resources they've got. So the modelling is only one ingredient. The humans end up making the decision, not the model.
Which I think is so important, isn't it, in terms of that. If your alarm's just gone off, good morning. Yes, it is hot. It's 22 degrees. You're listening to Professor Ted Lefroy, who's the director of the Centre for Environment at the University of Tasmania. And they work, amongst other things, they work to help researchers explain their research better to themselves and their stakeholders and people who are working on it. And he recently sat in on some of the country's top bushfire modellers and has a few things to say about how our bushfire models are being used and being understood. And it's nice to have a conversation sort of away from A, a fire happening, and B, anyone in the fire service, so it's not so precious, because it's really interesting. So eavesdropping on this three-day conversation, what are the concerns that the modellers, bushfire modellers, were raising with each other? What are they trying to do? Where do they want to go next?
They know the limitations of their models because of the huge uncertainties, the things we were just talking about how quickly wind direction and speed and weather conditions can change. One of their biggest concerns, I think, was the fact that a lot of us still expect the fire service to turn up like the cavalry whenever there's a fire. But in fact, some places are simply not going to be defensible. And the fire service uses a triage, that is, to decide which places are safe and don't need their attention, which places are indefensible and they just have to leave them, and which places they should devote their resources to because of the risks to themselves as well as everything else. It's on their website. You can go and look at it. They're making those sort of decisions all the time. One of the concerns is, when is that going to really be in the public consciousness, in the public domain, that not everywhere can be rescued under every situation?
This is starting to become more of an Australian conversation, though. I've been seeing more editorials and opinion pieces and papers and things to say we need to think about living in the bush differently.
But it's taking a long time, isn't it?
Do we need to go, I'd love to live in the bush, but if I do, I need 10 metres of concrete around me.
Well, yeah, maybe. It used to be the bushies lived in the bush. Now, lots of people do. The outer suburbs are in the bush. Tree change means that lots of people with no experience of that environment live in the bush. But it's not so much their fault. Our whole society is taking a long time to appreciate the role and the permanence of fire in this environment. One of the things I learned at that workshop, which surprised me, was a study by Sam Wood and some of his colleagues at the university. They used tree rings to date one of the last great big landscape fires in Tasmania. So I'd heard lots of foresters talk about these large areas of even age stands, very old growth trees, all about the same age. And by using tree rings, they worked out that this cohort germinated somewhere between 1490 and 1510. So 500 years ago, there was an enormous fire.
When the Chinese were here, according to one book. Yes.
Exactly. And it wiped out a lot of Tasmania's forest. And it took a long time. It's taken us 200 years, really, to realise the significance of fire in shaping this environment. So we're all taking a long time to get used to it. Now, if enormous landscape fires have a return time of 500 years, and we just arrived 200 years ago, no wonder it's taking us a while to realise where it is we live and how to adapt.
Does that mean, from your eavesdropping at this meeting, in terms of what they're talking about, that bushfire modelling experts, that they have some expectation of some massive fire? I grew up in Wellington in New Zealand, and every 2 years, it's like, oh, we're due for the earthquake of the millennium this week.
Well,
are we due a massive landscape fire, or?
Well, it's not called the shaky ass for nothing, is it? You knew that there was a likelihood, but nobody could say when.
No, and it hit Christchurch. It was ridiculous.
And with fires, those modellers can say with some certainty where are the places at greatest risk, but they cannot say when, because there are so many other factors. There are 30,000 deliberately lit bushfires in Australia, and the ignition point is the ignition point is one of the four big factors in predicting fire that nobody can predict. Where is that ignition point going to come?
The Gretna fire was ignited by
a wheel coming off a car. Okay, it was 32 or something degrees at Bushy Park, hot wheel nuts, dry grass, bingo, away she went. Nobody can predict that. So you can understand fuel loads, dryness, wind speed, all the weather conditions, but you can't pick the ignition point. So they realise the limitations of their knowledge. When you say, do they expect the great big fire? It's not that they expect it. They just know that that's the background. That's the history. That's the environment in which we live.
Great to speak to you this morning.
Pleasure. Thanks.
Really appreciate it. Ted Lefroy, Director of the Centre for Environment at the University of Tasmania, who in no way is an expert in this, but has been watching bushfire modellers for 3 days and has some really interesting things to say about how we live with our environment. In the streets of our town, it's the Go-Betweens.